Hey everybody, welcome to another Bald Movies. I'm your host Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And today we are back to talk about a 1992 film directed by Michael Mann, a epic action historical romance drama, Last of the Mohicans. It's set in the 1750s during the French and Indian Wars here in the American colonies. It was written by Michael Mann and Christopher Crowe, based on a historical novel of the same name written by James Fenimore Cooper. Michael Mann, of course, is the person responsible for the amazing heist film Heat, which we previously reviewed, as well as the movie Collateral, Public Enemies, and the TV show and movie Miami Vice. Jim, this is your first. This is my probably third time watching this film, and this is kind of a historically important film for me personally. It was the first rated R movie I'd ever seen in a theater. I think I was 15 at the time. A 17-year-old witness co-conspirator helped me sneak out to watch it. And also, first movie I saw with a girl, a worldly girl from high school. So I have fond memories of this film. I thought it was really, really good on third, I guess, watch with 20 years distance between it. What'd you think?
I don't know if this movie is for me. Of the things you listed, epic, period, romance, drama, action film, I think I like two of those. I like period films. This is maybe not like a super interesting period to me personally. There's not a lot, and it was something about like the whole just tone of this movie. It feels maybe a little too grown up for me in some kind of way. Like, you know, there's just nothing for me here. Like, it's a romance. I'm not interested in watching Daniel Day-Lewis and Madeline Stowe bone down. That's not fun for me.
Some awkward boning. Like, I felt like they didn't really know how.
So?
Yeah, I thought so.
I thought, like, it was fine.
They're going for passionate, but it came across as like people who don't know how sex works. Like, we're going to sit fully clothed on each other's laps and press collarbones into each other.
To be fair, she probably doesn't at that time in her stature, I guess. Yeah, but like, that's the thing. British drama with wartime shit that I know nothing about. I'll you know, mea culpa on that, because I know absolutely nothing about this era in history. You know, despite it taking place within my own country, just 200 years ago, which, you know, is modern history by a lot of country standards.
Sure.
So I don't know. The French Indian War is not something I've really looked into or ever even considered looking into. Maybe I should, but this is not going to be the movie that gets me to go research it a whole bunch.
Yeah, I actually kind of somewhat surprised that you didn't like the film, because I thought that you were at least not antagonistic to period pieces.
No, I'm not. It's some combination of like watching the English do military shit and this being a period piece is like just boring to me.
See, I thought there's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to dig into there, but like one of the things I really liked about this movie is I felt like it visually explains why the British got their ass kicked off the continent. Hmm. You know, this is just the story I've always been told in junior high and high school, and apologies to the Brits out there who are still seething over this 243-year-old conflict. But like, it's, yeah, like when you looked at the post-fort ass-kicking raid that the Indians portray, did over on the British, like, it just seems so self-evident. Like, you've got this brightly colored giant banner waving column of dudes beating drums and playing flutes versus dudes wearing camouflage moving through the cover of this dense North American forest and picking the exact terms of their engagement and firing from cover. Like, it just seems like, my God, why didn't they? And I hear that, like, that's the other thing is, like, you know, as you learn more about history, you'll learn the shit you learn in schools largely, like, simplified or wrong, that there were, like, commando units it's not like the British people had no idea how to conduct warfare. They fucking took over the whole globe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, still the bright red uniforms versus the dudes in camo knowing the lay of the land. And this is also, I just thought there's like really, every time I see historically accurate battles, I just think of how like fucking savage it all is. You know, the forts like exploding and the splinters hitting people and just like the sheer terror of like, you know, you're walking on the sunny day and you're like, you just escaped with your lives, you know, like you thought the morning before that you were going to die because of your British commander's honor demands that he fights to the last man. Now you're marching on a fair sunny day. Maybe you're going to see your sweetheart. And then you start hearing these war cries coming from all around you. Where are they? You're getting picked off from the forest. I like that kind of like a really, you know, even it's probably heightened Hollywood reality bullshit. It felt like I could kind of walk in those people's shoes and feel like what it was like to be back then when, you know, this entire continent was so much more mysterious and peopled by these, you know, peoples that were hostile, sometimes allies. How do you tell the difference? I thought that stuff was fascinating.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
What's your interest level in going and viewing some kind of colonial era war reenactment? Because that's what this movie feels like to me.
Mm.
I mean, I have like zero interest in that.
No, I do. Yeah. Cause I don't want to stand outside in a hot, you know, humid, fucking,
okay,
you know, upstate New York field with a, you know, yeah, no, I don't want to do that, but like, yeah, lavishly scaled, period accurate. I guess that, because I did a lot of research and they really sweated the details. Now, sweating the details in 1992 is different than it would be in 2020. Like, I thought it was interesting that the, shit, what is the guy that played the Indian chief, not West Duty, no, anyway, the guy that played the Chingachgook, he mentioned that because he's a famous Indian actor and
Russell Means.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Russell Means, kind of badass dude, like had a standoff on wounded knee against the federal government in 1971. Holy shit.
Yeah.
But this guy said that like they just wanted us to talk Indian. So like we all spoke in our native language. Like West Study is talking Cherokee and I'm talking my native tribe, and I was delivering these lines to some Inuit that spoke like, so we were just literally gibbering at each other, but it's like, oh yeah, authentic Native American shit. Oh yeah. So like nowadays they would actually sweat the details. They'd have, you know, an actual scholar that would, you know, but teach the people their lines, and there'd be a lot more. But for 1992, like they clearly, you know, sweated the details on the artifacts and the costuming and stuff like that. I think that's really neat.
And I think it being 1992 is another mark against it, in my opinion. Like the film doesn't look that good.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's grainy, and no matter how you're going to restore it, it doesn't look amazing. A lot of it is shot in very dark settings as well. And so like you know, you can do a better transfer of it, and I'm sure they have, but like didn't look that amazing to me.
I read an interview with the cinematographer where, cause I said that too. I was like, man, this is verging on too dark. But then I was thinking like, you know, it's really fucking dark on a moonless night in the forest. Like, I don't know if people have realized that, but like you get away from the city lights and you get out into still in the Midwest, there's a lot of fairly virgin, you know, forest, it's dark as hell. And you go into like a cave under a waterfall in the middle of the night, it's going to be dark as hell. And I saw that the cinematographer used as little artificial lighting as possible because he wanted to give that kind of realistic feel of this gloomy forest and like how dark it would be, and how easy it would be to like, you know, lose track of somebody. And so I think it was an intentional stylistic choice, but I guess I can see.
Well, the darkness is not the problem. It just looks like 1992. Like, you know, films look like the era that they're made in, and this looks like a 1992 film. It's just, it wasn't that impressive from like a film stock, essentially. Like, whoa, the film stock they're using, the cameras they're using are all like dated at this point.
Yeah. And,
you know, I'm not opposed to that, but like with my ambivalence going in, just like, and I don't hate this movie. I don't think it's a bad movie. I'm just like, meh. I have zero interest in ever watching this film again. And I'm, after, you know, seeing a few Daniel Day-Lewis films, I'm a huge Daniel Day-Lewis fan. I don't think this is his best work, but I don't think this is his best character either. So like, I don't know. I was expecting, I guess, some grand performance from him, and he is, I would say, a little bit better than passable here.
Huh.
Because the movie just doesn't demand much of him.
Before we get into spoilers, because I feel like that we can pivot, because I want to talk about Daniel Day-Lewis and his performance. Maybe I can give us a little brief synopsis to bring people up to speed. If you dimly recall this film, or if you haven't seen it and it sounds interesting. So this takes place in 1757 in the American colonies during the French and Indian War. A British army officer is tasked with escorting a colonel's daughters to one Fort William Henry, which is in modern day upstate New York. Along the way, they're ambushed by Indians that are allied with the French. That's why it's called the French and Indian Wars, because France was at war for control and supremacy on North American continent, and the Indians were kind of like played against each other, and for both sides. But they were ambushed by Indian forces on the way there, and only saved by three men, like these independent trappers, fur traders, a native chief, his son, which collectively are the last of the Mohican tribe, and his adopted white son, Hawkeye, who's played by Daniel Day-Lewis. These three agree to help escort the daughters to safety. But unfortunately, no safety be found at Fort William Henry, as it's quickly taken over by the French. Our heroes, under the circumstances, fall for the two daughters and become embroiled in a blood feud between a Huron war chief named Magua and essentially the entire English army. A lot of shooting, stabbing, and running between long, lingering looks then ensue. You mentioned that this is not a great Daniel Day-Lewis performance. I disagree. I think he did exactly what he was needed to do.
That's what I'm trying to say, is he did what he needed to do, but the movie didn't ask much of him.
Yeah, like there's a couple points where I just thought, like, you know, he's portraying this like cool, confident guy, and like the way he holds Cora's gaze, the way, like, there's a couple points where he told that one general, that major off, like, you know, you and I are going to, I feel like you and I are going to have a conflict or going to have a fight ahead. I really like those moments, but here's the thing. I found out that Michael Mann turned into the studio a 3-hour cut of this film. And the studio demanded that he cut this down to 2 hours, which he did. Now, you and I watched the director's final cut, which is about 5 minutes longer than the theatrical version. And I guess there's another, like, early director's cut that was on the first edition of the DVD that was like 3 minutes longer still. But I wonder what the fuck was on. I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's missing. When I look at this film, it looks like there's a little bit of stuff that's incomplete. For example, Uncas and his relationship with the younger Monroe daughter is entirely a sketch of like a couple of like shy, bashful glances. And if they had developed that to the extent that they had developed Daniel Day-Lewis and Cora, which itself was not a super well-developed relationship, I think they would have really had something. Could they have gone on and given, you know, Magua a few more scenes talking about his brutalization at the hands of the English, so you can really understand, like, you know, why he has this vicious hatred of the English? If there's a little bit more discussion amongst, like, you know, the French and Indian and the Indian English forces, so you could get, because like they don't give you any kind of grounding or scope to understand why this battle's happening, who the sides are, what the stakes were. And I feel like, you take a third of the movie away, it's kind of amazing that it works as well as it does. But I really want to see that cut, because I think that's where you find why you hire Daniel Day-Lewis to do stuff like this.
Yeah, it could be. I agree that romance, the secondary romance in this movie is so shortcutted and so thin. It shouldn't even have been in. Like, if you're going to cut most of that, cut it all. Like, I felt nothing when that girl jumped off, other than this poor young woman jumping off to her death. I didn't feel like, oh, she's lost, you know, the only person who she's ever loved, and like, I felt none of that. It was more just the tragedy of a young person throwing themselves off.
The flip side of that, of Uncas, like, you know, desperately sprinting to save her and getting himself killed, didn't land, because again,
right,
these were bystanders in the plot as far as the movie is concerned, and like a distractor, like it only served to give the old Mohican chief like super good reason to kill Magua. And I kind of felt like maybe in the full version, because I also did a lot of research in the original novel to try to figure out what the missing pieces were, and like if there was like also some bad blood between, you know, Magua's war chief or his war party and Chingachgook, the last of the Mohicans. I thought that would have been, but like I don't know, like all the stuff with Uncas and the younger Monroe daughter felt like it's just a little juice to give that extremely impressive last 5 minutes of the movie, which, my God, when the soundtrack kicks in and these guys are just sprinting. I mean, maybe that's why you get Daniel Day-Lewis, because this guy lived in like a cabin and homesteaded for like 6 months and trapped furs and whatnot just so he can sprint up and down these mountains and look convincing doing it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it worked.
Yeah, like all that shit where he was doing fancy knife work and tomahawk work and like reloading a fucking flintlock musket as he's sprinting Tom Cruise fast
on a cliffside, like
at a 45 degree granite face cliff. I just thought that shit was really cool, and all the action sequence, the initial ambush, the fort scene, you know, I'm a sucker for like nautical fiction, so like seeing these big cannons just blowing, like, and especially how monstrous they are in land, just blowing huge chunks out of this real fort that they built. It cost $6 million to build this thing up down in North Carolina.
There's definitely some cool stuff in there. Those cannons were very impressive. I was kind of digging that part, but yeah, I think the second half of this movie, or maybe the last third of this movie, is pretty good, and actually had my attention, but the first half to two thirds of it was just kind of nothing to me.
Yeah, but I think that, man, if you had another 15 minutes in that first half to like really introduce that settler folk in their cabin and like their relationship between the Mohicans and Hawkeye and et cetera, that would have landed too. Because, like, you know, we barely get to know these people. They're kind of like, oh, okay, minor characters. And then there's a point where they get butchered, and that's supposed to be a big moment. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really land
to the point where I wasn't even sure that was their family.
It's the same people. Yeah. I was afraid you'd say that.
Yeah. I mean, I got a single glimpse at this woman who they show lying on the ground, before that. And I was like, is this some other, like, is this another family? And they're looking at the tragedy of like everyone being, I really wasn't sure. I wasn't sure who like was sending out the war parties. Was it the Native American chiefs and their tribes sending out war parties to burn the people out? Was it the French, which I think that's right.
Well, I think that's one of the insidious parts that you're supposed to understand, and they kind of lost in war, is that like it was hard to tell. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of Indian tribes were allied and like were friendly with the English. A lot of them were allied with the French. A lot of them didn't like any of this shit that's happening to their land. Like, what the fuck is this white man doing, like burning and slashing our forests and, you know, camping on our native burial grounds, and fuck them all. So like, you know, it felt like an infinite atrocity engine that like whoever attacked you could brutally retaliate against whomever and justify whatever body count you could. And that they just lost that kind of like vicious, inhuman part of the French Indian Wars. And it's to its detriment. But my real question is, why did they choose to neuter Michael Mann's cut of this movie? Because so I was thinking like, okay, well, maybe like we're still a year or two away, because I get fuzzy when stuff came out in the 90s. Like, maybe we're still a year or two away from Dances with Wolves that proved like a 3.5 hour movie can fucking slay and get all the Oscars and get $500 million box office against a $100 million budget. But no, Dances with Wolves came out in 1990. This comes out in 92. Why the hell did they demand this guy just pull out an hour of his movie? They had just seen that American audiences have an appetite for this kind of like historical period, Western, Native American, greater respect and empathy and more nuanced view, more realistic view than we'd gotten with the John Wayne bullshit of years gone by. Why does the studio make this arbitrary? Now you got to get in there 2 hours. We got to really churn through the seats and the tickets, and the kids are going to get bored. this rated R, super violent historical drama.
Is it possible that that 3-hour cut is apocryphal, that it doesn't actually exist? Because if you're doing a definitive director's cut, why are you only adding 3 minutes back in? Who actually, I don't even know who did the definitive director's cut. I'm not sure if it was the director. It was? Okay. Yeah. Then, why wouldn't he have put that stuff back in if it actually existed?
So that's a good point. But on the other hand, I guess the young, I can't remember her name, Jody something or other, the youngest Monroe daughter, I guess was really complaining because this was a pretty grueling shoot. Like when they were in, there's a scene of they're fleeing the Huron war party in these canoes, and they go over a sequence of waterfalls. And I guess Michael Mann, with rare exception, insisted the actors not use stand-in and stunt people. So like these canoes like tipped all the fucking time. And I guess these women got cold and wet and miserable, and they spent a lot of time being cold and wet and miserable at night. And when she saw the final cut of the movie, she was outraged because I guess like literally 100%, like 95% of her role was on the cutting room floor. So like, there's a statement that like Michael Mann, Michael Mann made an interview that he had turned in a 3-hour cut. And then there's an actress that said that she was kind of shocked and outraged that a lot of her material was cut off. So like, okay. Maybe it's overselling a bit, but like even 20, 30 more minutes of character development, anything between Uncas and that girl, honestly, would have made the movie a lot better. And anything that would add a little bit of depth and shading to Magua. Cause I feel like they stripped him away to the bare essentials to where, he just seemed a lot more evil than I think is intended in the original material. Like, you're supposed to understand that he's got a lot of good fucking reason to hate these guys. And because it's so like cutting out someone's heart and eating it in front of them and swearing that you're going to kill their seed and burning their children alive, because that's so fucking over the top. Like, I felt like there needed to be some real heavy, oh, geez, well, you know, maybe I don't agree with his methods, but I see how he got there.
Yeah, they didn't have that. But I will say I thought Magua was a very effective villain.
Sure as hell is.
He's fucking terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and that just style of combat work where it's like, you know, you're breaking bones and it's blunt force trauma and it comes out of nowhere. Does seem pretty terrifying.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
I want to talk about some other, like another delightful piece of casting. You know, we love Jared Harris. This is his third credited role.
Nice.
As some nameless British lieutenant that's trying to whip the American colonists into some sense of patriotism to a country that they're going to throw the yoke of tyranny off just 10 short years later.
Yeah.
Almost didn't recognize him because he's so fucking young and fresh faced.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's Jerry Harris right up there on his literal high horse.
Yeah, it's a shame he didn't have more to do in this film.
Well, you know what? That 3-hour cut, 45 minutes, Jared Harris.
Only
they knew. If only they knew. A polar bear with a human face chased him down. bit his ass. It was something else.
We need the post expanse cut of Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Cutting that so much out of, I'm assuming, the runtime of the film did a lot of like making the political, like they did. It's like I felt like they had to tack on the colonists saying something about tyranny and oppression because, you know, this film's aware enough, like, well, this is French and Indian War, it's in early colonial America, but like, yeah, 10 years from now, they're going to fight a war of revolution, so we need to kind of like lay the tracks for that a little bit. But it felt a little very much tacked on, like, well, if we don't put this big speech in here, then American audience will be like, what the fuck? I thought the Brits were the bad guy, you know?
Yeah, and maybe that's a little bit more to doing a little more to convey like the epic scale of this thing, because like beyond a fort battle, I'm trying to find the epic part of this film, because the scale of the film is not that grand. The setting in general is grand, but like this is a very intimate story, I think.
Yeah, you're right. I think the fort is a big epic set piece, but I think immediately after that where they attack the retreating soldiers, the paroled soldiers.
My calibration on epic is just thrown off in 2020. You know, like in 1992, maybe this was epic. In 2020, this is a joke. We're trying to call this film an epic.
Well, I mean, if you're comparing it to against like 1917, if you're comparing it against what was that? Nolan movie, Dunkirk, but like 400 like authentic Native Americans squaring off against 300 British soldiers, and I thought that, I mean, that felt epic to me, because I've rarely seen that kind of combat played out with this kind of like level of attention to detail and skill, and just like,
yeah, but I've seen things like Battle of the Bastards, I've seen things like sure, Avengers, yeah. Like it's Lord of the Rings. It's really fucking hard to get on my epic scale and to peg that scale. So like this 1992 film with, you know, 50 extras at a time is not really cutting the mustard here.
But that's the thing. I think that's where like the knowledge of like all the stuff that you just mentioned is mostly CG and compositing, where like this is like one of the epic in the old Hollywood ways, where it's like, you know, Charles Heston is in front of 1,000 people in the desert, like fucking like those are actual people, all costumed, all moving around, hitting their marks. Like that's fucking epic. Like
Conan, right?
Similar scene. Yeah, when you see this, just like tons of, and those are real people. Like when they're just stretching out in this vast distance, that's like real fucking people. I think it's epic in that way. But I take your point. It's not, you know, like my son Jack would not, he would not sit down and watch this movie willingly.
No. And that's why I never watched it, because it came out when I was 10 years old. And, you know, from 10 to 25, I had zero interest in anything like this. Yeah. I still have very little interest, but.
It's funny because, like, as a 15-year-old, I thought I did a damn fine job picking a date film, because it is very romantic. Yeah. Like, Daniel Day-Lewis is very dashing and handsome. And also, like, the daughter, Cora, was fairly fierce. You know, she gets to kill a dude. She's not a helpless damsel in distress. But there's, you know, lots of Daniel Day-Lewis when he's screaming, "I will find you," before he throws himself off a waterfall, Harrison Ford style. Like, Cecily was watching me, and she was getting, you know, hot in the bonnet for it. I'm trying to think, like, what I made, because, like, all my memories of this film, like, seen in the theater are, like, also intermingled with, like, the awareness that I'm sitting and holding hands with a girl for the first time.
Sure.
And she looks really pretty, and she smells good, and, you know, should I put my arm around her now? Like, because, like, this film is very adult, like you said. Yeah. I can't imagine that I really enjoyed, other than the action scenes. And I also remember being horrified, because you recall I'm a horror pussy. Like Magua cutting that dude's heart out almost made me pass out. And I'm like, well, I can't do that in front of this girl.
Wow. Wow.
And that dude getting burned at the stake made me like physically queasy.
Yeah.
And it's still a pretty effective scene, honestly. Like, you know, get burned alive. That's some rough fucking justice, man.
Yeah, I kept waiting for that moment where he says, you know, someday you and I are going to have a real serious disagreement. I kept waiting for that to come back, and I'm kind of glad it didn't. Like, that felt right.
They had a serious disagreement, but it was nothing like he was expecting.
No. You're right. The disagreement was who's going to sacrifice their life for Madeline Stowe's character.
Yeah. I really enjoy the soundtrack. I think the soundtrack won, or at least was nominated for some Oscars. Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman. Trevor did the soundtrack for Excalibur, Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Mississippi Burning, as well as this film. And Randy Edelman worked on the movie Twins, Kindergarten Cop, Beethoven, Gettysburg, Dragonheart, Triple X, and you're going to love this, Jim.
Oh, Jesus.
Wrote the theme for the popular 80s television series MacGyver.
No shit. Okay. He redeemed himself.
Yeah. But I it's weird because I like the soundtrack. When I was listening to it yesterday, I was like, this is coming across way more Gaelic than like Native American or colonial period.
Huh.
Like it's very Scottish Islands, like Rob Roy, Braveheart.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. I dug it. And like I said, that score to the final like 5-minute chase scene is just gets the blood pumping.
Yeah, I feel you.
Epic or no.
and this theme, it's interesting because I've never seen this movie, but I have most certainly heard this song many times, the theme for Last of the Mohicans. Didn't know it until I watched this movie that it was Last of the Mohicans. So that was kind of interesting, but I couldn't believe the frequency at which they play the Last of the Mohicans theme. It's like every single time they need somebody to look heroic or something to look romantic and magical, they go to this theme. And I was like, they must have played it 10, 15 times by the end of this film. No wonder everybody knows this theme, right? Because you can't watch this movie without having it written forever into your mind.
It's the Groundhog Day of soundtracks.
Yeah, absolutely.
But on the other hand, I think it also is a mainstay in like historical period trailers for like the next 20 years.
Okay. Yeah, that
like,
makes sense.
You're going to get it in like football montages of people trying to get the extra few yards across the
They did that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you'd see a lot of like stirring like places, placeholder music and trailers and things like that.
Did you know the storied history, I guess, of this musical production that they had? So I can't remember which one of the names you mentioned, but they were hired to write an electronic score to this thing, if that makes any damn sense in the world.
I saw this as a avenue to go down, and I just rejected it as fundamentally uninteresting. But Trevor Jones is the one originally hired, and then he bowed out late in the project because Michael Mann was still cut. Like, he filmed the waterfall scene 9 days before he showed it to an audience for the first time. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
So, and this thing was getting like, you know, this guy like worked up a score for the 3-hour version, and then they gave him the two, and he's like, fuck this. So,
he did the electronic version and had it like basically done. And then late in production, Michael Mann comes to him and says, now we need a score for this thing. We need a traditional orchestral score. And so he had to go back and music everything. He had to create the score from scratch again. And like, he did as much as he could. He blasted through the thing, and then he ran out of time. I guess within his own personal schedule, he had other projects or something. And so they brought in a guy to finish it up. And I think it's remarkable how well it works, but I think maybe I see why they use the theme over and over again, because that's the music they had, and they were like, well, we wrote two songs for this. Let's use one of them a lot.
Yeah, yeah. The last thing I want to talk about is, like, I was watching this, and there's this point where Magua is essentially got this massive chip on his shoulder because he was kidnapped by the Mohawk tribe and kind of, like, stripped of a lot of his... They thought his tribe, the Hurons, thought he was dead. His wife got married to another man. Like, he lost a lot of his honor and prestige, and I get the feeling that a lot of this is him trying to win it back. And he goes to this chief and he says, oh, look at all this victory I've done. I've killed many gray hairs. And then Daniel Day-Lewis comes in and is like, nah, this guy's talking out of both sides of his mouth. He's actually a real fuckface of a Native American.
He
loves the French and the ways of Yangi and their greed and all. And I'm thinking... And then the elder chief said something profound, which he says, since I have been a child, my tribe has pondered this one question. what is the Huron to do? And I'm thinking, like, that's really fucking profound. Like, if you're this Native American and, like, essentially time before out of mind, the ways have been the ways, and then you have these guys come over in ships with horses and steel and guns, and they're like the aliens from Independence Day, except for they don't go away when you infect them with the, in fact, they're infecting you with disease and shit. And like, what is the answer? Because it seems like Magua is saying, and there's this also, I read this review where they said that at this point in like American history, the Native Americans were actually richer and more powerful and way more numerous than the colonists. Like if they banded together as an entire nation, like all the nations came together and said, "Nah, fuck, we're going to kill these fuckers as fast as they come on the shore." They probably could have essentially like staved off the invasion indefinitely, but that it would have entailed them giving up their way of life. Cause Mach was saying like, let's fucking, we can out trap these guys. We can outfur these guys. We can get rich off gold and silver. We can buy guns. We can fight back. And Daniel Day-Lewis is essentially saying, yeah, but then you're not even really a Huron, are you? And that's bullshit counsel. Like, Magua was 100% right when he's like, this guy's talking out of a poison forked tongue. This guy's talking our destruction. This is going to lead to us. But, like, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I thought that point was, like, I wish there was more to support it because, holy shit, I really felt for that old Indian chief at that. Because he's like, what the hell do you do?
Yeah.
Become the enemy to keep from being defeated by the enemy?
Right. And I think, you know, in certain ideologies and ones that I maybe, you know, if I lived with under those ideologies for a long time, I would probably agree with them. I'm not sure how I feel about them as, you know, just some American dude. But sometimes they'd rather die than give up the things that make them. And I think that's kind of a valid way to look at your life. I don't know. I think there are certainly lines on all sides of that equation, and you need to, I guess, figure out where the blur is there. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure which side I come down on that, because I think everybody's got a point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I haven't thought about it enough to have a firm opinion on it.
Yeah. And I like I said, I just thought it was one of those interesting points where like I never pondered it from that point. Like, you know, I'd always considered the fact that the Europeans would roll up with the superior technology and just roll, but like the idea that there was a tipping point where they just didn't have like it's way harder to bring dudes over from another continent than you have millions here of your own, and you've already got enough because they have foolishly employed both sides in their various petty wars against each other. You now have a sizable amount of weapons, and you could probably manufacture your own, and you can make your own gunpowder, and like you could band together and push these invaders off, or at least greatly slow their numbers. Maybe sue for better terms of peace. Maybe half of the North American continent would still be controlled by the First Nations. Mm-hmm. Had things gone a little bit. And there's also some interesting stuff, I guess, because I'd read that previously in like the Central and South American. If they had like gotten their shit together when the Spaniards first came, they could have like pushed them off. But the other some historical what ifs is like, you know, so we gave the Native Americans the Black Plague. They gave us syphilis. What if it was the other way around? What if we brought the syphilis and they had the Black Plague? Like in the Americas were just like, man, you go there and half your people are going to die if you're lucky. Like there's just a lot of historical what ifs about this thing. And I just thought that scene with the war chief and how he ultimately decides to go with like, well, We're gonna go down swinging the way we always have, rather than try to adopt the naked greed and the disease of war that these white men are obsessed with. It's super poignant. It's like a scene from a better, more interesting film.
Yeah,
which I still think this is a, you know, this is this film's got like a 95% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And interestingly enough, because you know I always check Roger Ebert, he seemed like he was a little bit whelmed on his review too. Like, yeah, it's a great film. It's okay. 3 stars.
Sure, you know I might have given it 2 out of his 4, but okay. It's right in the middle. It's right down the middle. I think I rated this on Letterboxd as a 3. So, as average as I can get.
Running Daniel Day-Lewis with Tomahawk's going to be haunting your dreams tonight. Because he's coming for you, Jim. He's coming for you. He wants that extra star.
You know, he's probably like 60 years old at this point. I still couldn't take him.
You think you could take him?
No,
man, what a wild career, because he was just an indie darling up until this, and he comes in here like a full-blown action, convincing action star. And then this is the same guy that plays, what was the Daniel Plainweather, Plainfucker?
View? Is it Plainview?
Is that it? Yeah, I know, something almost borderline ironic from There Will Be Blood, and he's Abraham Lincoln and Lincoln. Those are very different roles and different sensibilities and physicalities. And I guess that's why...
Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York, right.
He's very different than that.
Yeah. But anyway, glad I got to see this movie. We, for next week, have a little bit of an interesting tie-in with a new club-only feature that we've unveiled, Bald Move Off the Clock, which is where Jim and I talk about TV shows that we're not doing full coverage on. We're just kind of talking as friends and buddies about. We're going through Alex Garland's new dev series that came out in the middle of Westworld, and we didn't have time for it. But we're going back and kind of doing a leisurely watch through that, and we really like it. And to get more into I just mentioned the guy's name.
Alex Garland. He's the guy who did Annihilation recently. He did 28 Days Later. He did The Beach. He did Dread. He did Sunshine. Some of my favorite films.
He wrote all those.
Yeah.
But he did write and direct Ex Machina. And I guess there's a lot of interesting themes that tie into the dev stuff. So we are going to, because we're on a Alex Garland kick, we're going to watch Ex Machina next week. So if you want to check that out so you can keep up with the reviews along with us, please do so. And if you are a club member or are inclined to be one, check out our off the clock coverage of his fantastic futurist AI fucking meaning of free will. Is life even free will? Is it deterministic meditation? Devs on FX, which you can check if you I think that's FX on Hulu too. You can watch it on Hulu as well. That's it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion around The Last of the Mohicans, and I hope you can join us for next week's Ex Machina. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next week.